You've tuned in to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Today on the forum, we have Father John Deere, who was speaking at the Community Christian Church on April 2nd earlier this year. Here's Georgia Walker with the introduction.
Tonight is the first step in what we're calling the Campaign Nonviolence Kansas City. It's the effort of a number of organizations to make nonviolence normative in Kansas City, to settle our disputes and settle our issues nonviolently as opposed to beating each other up and shooting each other. This is just the first step. A number of organizations came together and said, we want to join the national movement that's being started by Pache Ebene, an organization that has the goal of having this fall events in cities all across the country. In September, there will be events of resistance to the war culture, the permanent war culture that's being waged, and to change the dialogue that will occur during the campaigns. So we're trying to start it now, but keep revving up more and more things. There are a number of organizations that are independently in Kansas City doing a lot of good work to bring about more nonviolence. However, this is just one tiny effort to bring a number of organizations together around this issue. John is going all over the country speaking at cities at events like this where organizers are coming together and trying to brainstorm how do we get the word out to the public? How do we become educators, motivators, agitators, activists? That's what it's going to take to change the culture of that violence is usual, typical solution to everything. So this is just the first step. Tomorrow night you're invited to a free, simple supper, and some of the leaders of these different organizations are going to talk about ways you can personally get involved. What I'm hoping that you will be stimulated to do is to come back again tomorrow night and get some good ideas about how you can take part in this initiative. We're blessed, I think, tonight to have a man who has spent the last three decades or so agitating, inspiring, and he is both a writer, a theologian, a teacher. He's written over 30 books. He's taught in universities. He's spoken to thousands of people worldwide. He's been to four different continents speaking. And he's worked with Mother Teresa in the campaign against the death penalty. He's worked with Desmond Tutu and now Nelson Mandela in South Africa. He has gone to prison how many times? 75 times? More or less? 70? No, probably more. And he's done all of this, and he's not even 100 years old yet. So just imagine what the next two decades will be. So I'm very pleased to present Father John Deere.
involved in that anymore. I had someone else for coming who was bringing money. I was going to thank church and all the different groups that pitched in to help out. But especially George, who wrote and invited me. So how about everyone? I was standing down here, I thought it would be a little bit more fun than it's horrible. But this looks a little scary, I think. You heard the story of the young priest giving his first sermon, and he's really nervous. And he comes to the podium and he taps on the microphone and says, "Something's wrong with this microphone," and the congregation goes, "And also with you." My best joke, everybody. That's a good story. Thank you so much, all of you, for what you're doing for peace and justice. And thank you for all you're doing for the God of peace and justice, for the world's poor, for the churches. And I just want to urge you to carry on and keep at it. You know, George, I just have to tell you, I have such mixed feelings coming to Kansas City. And I thought I would just be vulnerable and tell you that. The Kansas City plant, nuclear weapons development, right here in the heart of America. Now I'm just going to go even farther. Harry Truman. You know, for me, I remember the day he died, and I was asking him about this. You know, I don't know what happened to me. I'm 54 years old, but I was a kid, and I'm going, he died in his sleep at the house. I think in Independence. And he vaporized hundreds of thousands of people. But I'm not condemning him or judging him. I'm just saying he's a symbol of everything we're against. And he's a good man and he did a lot of good works. But he's the culture. So I went to the house on the way here today. It was really scary for me. It was like a nonviolent action. All I could do was sit in the car and look at it. And then I thought, well, I might as well. Things are bad in Kansas City. I went to the museum because you can go to the grave for free. And he's been haunting me my whole life. I don't know how you all do that. You're living in the shadow of Harry Truman. And they prayed at his grave. And I forgave him. And I said, my friends and I, Georgia and I, and all of you, are spending our lives trying to undo the evil you've done. And we're all part of it. And God, peace, give us the gift of nuclear disarmament. While I'm so discouraged, I'm so inspired by all of you. Because you are standing up and saying no to drones nearby, to Whiteman, to Leavenworth, where Bradley Manning is, to the Kansas City plant where they build 85% of parts of nuclear weapons. And what I read was it's really a cutting-edge uranium process that they're trying to upgrade. This is great. This is really important what we're trying to do. And I thank you for it. I was thinking all day about this. Because while Truman was celebrating the vaporization of hundreds of thousands of people, there was another great person. Well, there's so many, Dorothy Day and all, but Mahatma Gandhi around the world. From that day to an hour within his death, was speaking against nuclear weapons in the name of God and offering a whole other vision of life, which was what Jesus tried to do. And that's what I want to reflect with you, if you can stand it. Some thoughts about violence and this world of war, nonviolence and the hope for peace. A little bit about my book, The Nonviolent Life, and some of our Christian roots for doing all of this, and then we'll have time for questions and comments and reflections and rebuttal. How does that sound, Georgia? Okay. And by the end of the evening, we will have resolved everything. just to share a little bit of it. I mean, for me, I invite you, as I'm reflecting, to reflect on your own life. What happened to you? How are you moving out of the culture of war and violence into the new life of peace and love? It's such an important question. And it's a great way to look at life. You know, we're turning and waking up, and how from this day forward to our last day on earth, we can go deep into peace and nonviolence, and our lives can make a difference to build a movement for a new future of peace and to serve the God of peace. Isn't that a great way to look at life? As I said, I think I'm 54, and my journey happened before I entered the Jesuits. I went on a pilgrimage to Israel to see where Jesus lived by myself. I was going to hitchhike for 3 months. Only the week I left, Israel invaded Lebanon. You may remember the Summer War of 1982. It was all orchestrated at the Pentagon. We now know we facilitated the killing of 60,000 people. And all the Holy Land tours were canceled. And I hitchhiked through Israel. And I was camping out illegally for 2 weeks by the Sea of Galilee. And it was so beautiful. And then I visited the Chapel of the Beatitudes. If you've been there, it's a little church on the North Shore. They had the Beatitudes on the wall. Hunger and thirst for justice. Blessed are the peacemakers. And love your enemies. And I was utterly overwhelmed by this. And what happened to me was I thought, I think this guy really wants us to do this stuff. What? That's so stupid to say that. Like, nobody said, he doesn't actually want us to do that. It can't be true. Do anything. Do everything but that. Hunger and thirst for justice. Be a peacemaker. Love your enemy. Just as I was standing at the balcony, coming to grips with that, all these Israeli jets fell from the sky, breaking the sound barrier. Boom, boom, boom. And they swooped down over the Sea of Galilee, flew over my head and dropped a whole bunch of bombs and killed people 15 miles away. It changed my life. Later, I realized it had been happening every hour the whole time I was there. I just wasn't thinking. Who cares? Who cares about the Kansas City plan? You just go through your life until you wake up. And I thought, right, well, I'm going to get with the program and try to do like Georgia and all of you and just do what we can. Only I went and sat at the feet of Daniel and Philip Berrigan. Dan was like, I wanted to ask him the meaning of life. He's 92. And in a nursing home now, you know, the great Barrigans, the heroes of peace. And I said, what's the point of all this again, Dan? And he said this beautiful thing to me. All you have to do is make your story fit into Jesus' story. And I thought, oh, that's wonderful. I thought he was going to say, end all wars and nuclear weapons. But on second thought, what he said was even harder. Then I went and was with Philip Berrigan, and he's smoking a cigarette and goes, go get arrested, kid, at the Pentagon and report back to me. You're with the Berrigans, you have these excuse, you start getting arrested, now you've already been arrested like 75 or 80 times, and I'm a full-fledged ex-con, can never vote again. The government considers me as high a terrorist as you can get, can't travel to a lot of countries, I'm under very serious surveillance. I've been in and out of court since my first arrest at the Pentagon 30 years ago. And I have a serious problem with recidivism now, George. Thank you. And like some of you here, too, I went to El Salvador and lived and worked with the Jesuits who were later assassinated. That was really life-changing, the refugee camp. But that led me to go with Philip Berrigan onto the Seymour Johnson Air Force Base, like our friend Carl Cabot here. And we walked onto the largest Air Force base in the country with the F-15 nuclear-capable fighter bombers 20 years ago. Incredible experience. It's like three O'Hare airports. At 4 in the morning, there are tens of thousands of soldiers milling about. What do you do for peace? We walked right through the middle of it, came up to one of the fighter bombers, each pulled out a hammer, and I went up to the side and swung once on the fighter bomber like that. Didn't even chip the paint. My friend Bruce's hammer broke in half. These things are so indestructible. And as I said to the judge later, Your Honor, just doing what it says in the Bible. The Holy Prophet said someday these people are going to come along and beat their swords into plowshares and study war no more. Is there an issue here? Is there a problem with that? I'm just doing what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, in this famous commandment, love your enemies, don't nuke them. the actual translation from the original Greek.
Yeah, that didn't go over well with the judge.
We faced 20 years in prison. You know, like Sister Megan and the current posters. Ours was about 50 of them, about 100 posters. Carl has done and others. And Phil and I and Bruce, we ended up in a little cell about this big. We never left the cell. Almost 9 months. It was really horrific experience for me. And that's everybody's experience is different. We were in county jails in rural North Carolina. And the walls were closing in because I was facing, I thought, at least 5 years. But we took out the Bible and we started with chapter 1, verse 1 of the Gospel of Mark, and we get about three sentences and the heavens opened and all the scriptures were explained. And then we took a piece of Wonder Bread, which we got for breakfast every day, and on Mondays we had the little plastic cups with the grape juice. Remember, we used to get those in the airplanes. And we found that if you put the grape juice in the top of the toilet in the back, it ferments quite nicely over time. And we broke the bread and passed the cup, and it was like God was right with us. It was the worst experience of my life, and hands down the greatest experience. I would say there's an inverse proportionality to this work for peace. The more you and I try to do, which is what I've done, years of Jesuit training, we're good Americans, we're going to end these problems, which we have to try to do. We organize and speak, it's like the less happens. And the more you let go and risk your life and walk forward in faith and take risks for justice and peace, the more happens. Now, we get out of the way and God can move and miracles can happen. I've seen it. I was working with the Fellowship of Reconciliation. I invited all the living Nobel Peace Prize winners on an all-expense-paid trip to Iraq. Okay, it was a little over the top, but what do you do? And one of them said to me on the phone, we were going to meet Saddam. We were the highest level delegation to get into Iraq in 12 years. And we did spend an evening with terror cousins. And he said to me, one of the Nobel laureates said, when we meet Saddam, I'll kill him myself with my own bare hands. And I'm like, and you won the Nobel Peace Prize. This is it was so incredible to go to Iraq. I'll just tell you one story. I hope you don't mind me sharing some of my journeys, or forgive me if you've heard all this before, but we met 10,000 people. Most of them have been killed. This was in 1999 in opposition to the sanctions, which we know now killed 500,000 children under 5 in Iraq, which led to September 11th in retaliation. We pull up in Baghdad to the Catholic high school for girls. And there we are, standing on the sidewalk, and here are 500 high school girls standing in total silence. This was impressive. A little scary. They had been preparing for us. And they break into song, singing in Arabic, Dr. King's civil rights anthem, "We Shall Overcome." Deep in my heart, I do believe we shall live in peace. We'll walk hand in hand. We are not afraid. And then as one, all 500 girls burst into tears and started sobbing. And then they charged us. And here come 100 girls and they surrounded me. And one of them cried out, I'll never forget, a hand went up in the air, "Why are you trying to kill us? What have we done to you? We want to be friends with the kids in America. And you're killing us." That's what I heard every day by thousands of people. I suspect most of them are dead. All the UN officials died. I could go on and on about that experience. At September 11th, I was the coordinator of the chaplains for the Red Cross working at the Family Center. And that too was incredible when working at Ground Zero. While organizing the demonstrations against the U.S. bombings in Afghanistan at Times Square, and in Union Square, and this was a good thing. It seemed to me, love your neighbor, love your enemy. But the church had so many complaints about me, I was kicked out and moved to New Mexico, the poorest state in the country, and number one in military spending, number one in nuclear weapons, number one in everything. Drunk driving, domestic violence, alcoholism, suicide. number one in child hunger. We think that 3,000 nuclear weapons at the Albuquerque airport. Did you all know that? Maybe the only other place on the planet more is a city way up in the north of Russia. They're all at Kirkland Air Force Base, right at the airport. And it's so poor. It's really like Mexico. But in Los Alamos, the beautiful mountain outside of Santa Fe, there are more millionaires per capita than any other place on the planet, and more PhDs. And that's what's going on here at your plant. Obama is trying to rebuild the Los Alamos National Laboratories, the birthplace of the Hiroshima bomb. He's building this chemical metallurgy research replacement facility, it's called, for $4 billion. A state-of-the-art plutonium bomb factory. I'm saying this because of what you all are up against here. It's the same thing with Oak Ridge. Under George W. Bush couldn't actually imagine it. He wasn't that confident even to think of making nukes better. Obama is doing everything. He's done more for nuclear weapons than anybody since Ronald Reagan in 1983. And I say that because we have people in New Mexico, there are five of them, who are giving their lives to studying every day the math, the budgets, and the details. The stories they tell are just frightening. What do you do? What we ended up doing was we spent a year in our church groups. We read the book of Jonah. So we remember Jonah walked through Nineveh and called them all to repent. We formed the Sackcloth and Ashes subcommittee. It's a good church subcommittee. I'm trying to make you laugh and it's not working. Small sackcloth, small, medium, and large. On the 60th anniversary of Hiroshima, 500 of us or something gathered in Los Alamos. Strict Gandhian satyagraha training. We had a prayer that we processed throughout the entire town, because the whole town is a nuclear weapons lab and a total radioactive pit. It's the ultimate place of death on the planet, I submit. And right at the mark, we all put on our sackcloth. We had big bags of ashes, 500 of them. We poured the ashes on the ground. It's the oldest symbol of protest in the world. You know, sackcloth and ashes goes back thousands of years as a protest. And it symbolizes Hiroshima. And we sat down in strict silence for 30 minutes to beg the God of peace to repent the mortal sin of war and nuclear weapons. And to beg the God of peace for the gift of nuclear disarmament. And after 30 minutes, we all got up and processed back to the park where they actually built the Hiroshima bomb. And I've been to thousands of demonstrations. The only one where every person had tears coming down their face because they were so moved. We're trying to get past the us and them, but to try to engage, Gandhi says, in some symbolic activity and to say no to this. We can't afford it. It's so evil. It's bad for children. All the things you're doing here in Kansas City, which is so critical. And trying to build a movement. Well, this hasn't gone over very well, as you can imagine. The Archbishop kicked me out of New Mexico. He removed my faculties as a Catholic priest. I think I'm the first priest, I may be wrong, but the first priest in the United States to have his faculties, that's the documents allowing you to say Mass, have them removed because of my work to end war. It never happened to Berrigan or Merton or anybody. It's terrible. You know, so I went in to see him. He gets all his money from the Catholics at Los Alamos. There are 20,000 people there. They're all Christian. This is really serious. It's like Auschwitz. They go to Mass every morning, the guards at Auschwitz, or at Bible studies. And then you spend your day putting people in gas chambers. How did we get like this? I said to him, Archbishop, actually, the church is against nuclear weapons. I don't know if you heard that, but it's right there in the documents. No, we need nuclear weapons. Well, actually, Archbishop, I said, in the Bible, it's quite clear. God is supposed to protect us. Like, God, it actually says it in the Psalms, God is our security. Oh, no, God can't protect us anymore. Nuclear weapons, he said to me, are our only security. Our only hope in the face of rogue nations. I couldn't believe the blasphemy I was hearing, and I was so upset, and I almost said, being a smart aleck, okay, Archbishop, if you don't believe in God, I didn't say that. I said, moved on to Jesus. Well, okay, Archbishop, Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, love your enemies. You and I have to help our people from working to prepare, to vaporize them. He said, no, you don't have to follow Jesus anymore. This is really life-changing for me, because I've heard from millions of people why we should kill, but to see a very prominent church people say that to me was very, very upsetting. And I've been banned by pretty much every bishop in the United States from speaking in Catholic churches. Your archbishop here has been very firm. You know, I was to give a retreat to 1,000 young people in Kansas, and maybe some of you know about this, and a public lecture on the theme was Jesus to the young people, and to a public lecture on Jesus, and then a weekend retreat on Jesus to uppity nuns, those troublemaking women. And he heard about it, and it was totally canceled. And he wrote me a letter and said, nobody who's been arrested should ever be speaking about Jesus. I wrote to him, I said, have you not heard that Jesus was arrested? He was executed by the emperor. This didn't go over well. What do you do?
You've been listening to Father John Deere on today's forum right here on 90.1 FM KKFI. We'll be right back with more after these messages. We now return to the forum with Father John Deere, who spoke earlier this year on April 2nd at Kansas City's Community Christian Church. Here he is.
So I was punished and ordered to move to Baltimore by the Jesuits, and they in effect put me under house arrest and did everything to get me to leave. So sadly, I've left the Jesuits. I'm hoping to stay a priest and join a diocese out west, where I feel pretty welcome, and to continue this trouble making work for peace. But I'm just back from South Africa for a month, and I want to just share a word about that too, because it was so darn exciting. It was a lifetime dream of mine to go and learn from the people who've given their lives in the struggle against apartheid. And I went with friends of mine whose family was raised there, and Father Ray Easton, some of you know him. And we went to Johannesburg and went to Soweto. In the 80s, I had a parish in Washington, D.C., and so did Father Ray. We were sister parishes of the famous Catholic Church in Soweto, which were actually the focus of all the anti-apartheid work in the whole country, if you've been to Regina Mundi. It was so great to go there. And I met with Winnie Mandela, whom I had corresponded with in the 80s. And that was so exciting, a poor, dear woman. And then I went to Pietermaritzburg. Okay, you realize I'm a little over the top. You all know your Gandhi story, right? Remember the movie Gandhi, the opening scene? He's a dopey 21-year-old kid. His family is so embarrassed by him. He's a new young lawyer. They ship him off to South Africa to live with his uncle because he's so incompetent. He buys a first-class ticket, which is only white people. It's the middle of the night. Remember the movie? And he's thrown off the train bodily. It's totally true. He said, till the day he died, actually, in an interview, the greatest experience of his life. Because here he is in the middle of nowhere in South Africa, in a train station, there's no anybody, and it's freezing cold, and it's really scary. What do you do? He's thrown onto the platform, and he stays there till 9 o'clock the next morning, going through this deep inner turmoil. What do we do in the face of injustice? Do we sit back and do nothing? And he read his autobiography and said, the moment I stood up, my active nonviolence began. We went to the train station. It's the same train station from 1893. The goofy orange brick Victorian building. The same waiting room. There's some plaques to honor Gandhi, and we prayed at that spot on behalf of all of us for a portion of his spirit, that we too might commit our lives to fighting injustice. Then we went to Durban, where he formed his first ashram. Then we went to Port Elizabeth. Remember Steve Biko in the movie Cries Freedom? We prayed at Steve's grave and went to his family's house, where he was put under house arrest, something I've been under house arrest many, many times. And I was always inspired by Steve Biko as a kid. He was killed at 30, but he had a vision. In many ways, he's greater than Mandela, because he offered a vision. Then we went to Cape Town and to Robben Island. Oh, what an experience. And Cape Town is the most beautiful place on the planet. And Robben Island, you know, the tour guides there are the former ANC prisoners. They're all now in their 70s, and they're all Mandela's friends. And they're very well paid, and they can really tell the story.
And I'm looking at Mandela still. It's so powerful they talk about Mandela with these people, but I'm going, doesn't look that bad. I'm just saying, Carl, you know, with our experience. And the jailers, or the jailers, the tour guides, were saying, you know, all you American activists say that. Your jails are so much worse than what we went through here. But 27 years working in the line for it. Anyway, the last thing I spent with Archbishop Tutu. And then having been, you know, 2 weeks ago, the Archbishop of Seattle banned me from the state of Washington from speaking in any Catholic church. And you see, I'm mainly talking about Jesus and peace and love. Tutu catered a meal for me. He's like welcoming me like royalty. And we had Eucharist. And the first thing he said to me is what I want to say to you. I walk in the door, he puts his arm around me and goes, we can never give up this work for justice and peace, John. Ever. I was so moved by that, and I'm saying that to you. He's 82. He's been under death threats since he was 13. He's speaking out now as much as ever, especially under the corruption of the ANC. And the next day he was leaving for Iraq, which is no joke. And being a smart aleck, I said to him, oh, come on, Archbishop Tutu. How do you do it? How do you do it? And he leaned forward and he whispered to me, I cry. Just heartbreaking. I thought, oh, I keep forgetting this is a real Christian. Every day, he said, since I was a boy, I've cried over the world. And I know now that we have a God who weeps. Because we don't get it that we're all sisters and brothers. But I also laugh a lot. I cry and I laugh. And I go forward in the work for justice and peace. And I share that message with you. I actually wrote a chapter on that in my new book, The Emotional Life of Nonviolence, because that's what Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount. Fear and anger don't work for the long haul, but grief and joy are the emotions to cultivate for the activist. So here's my thought in a nutshell. My friend just died, Jonathan Schell, the author of The Fate of the Earth, a great, great hero. He once said, we were giving a retreat together, and he said, if you really look at the whole world, it's a world of total violence. You know this, and I know, but how do you describe it? 25 wars, 20,000 nuclear weapons, the UN says over a billion people are malnourished, 4 billion in subhuman poverty, catastrophic climate change bearing down upon us, and the structured violence leading to every other form of violence you can imagine that we're all resisting, racism, sexism, torture, executions, name any form of violence. And it's internalized in us and legitimate, and perfectly normal, and totally spiritual, and even holy. This is the will of God. We get to go and steal all the resources of the earth for us Americans. The good news is not love your enemies, we get to kill them and take their stuff for ourselves. Wow, it's just absolutely incredible. Did you see the Oxfam report recently? 85 billionaires have more money than the bottom 50 nations of the world combined. Some 3 to 4 billion people, equal to 85 human beings. So unfair. We're 3 weeks to go and the congressional record announced that secretly the Congress voted to upgrade our nuclear weapons and weapons of mass destruction and Trident submarines for the next 10 years, and then for the next 2 decades after that. So for the next 30 years, the vote was passed, $1 trillion for more work on weapons of mass destruction. Sometimes I think we're living in like a zombie movie. I don't know. You know, people are crazy. Sometimes it's like we're just addicted. Or it's an epidemic, as you were saying. And then I think biblically, what we're talking about is death. Death as a social methodology. This is biblical language beyond Paul's principalities and powers, where we bring death. Anything bringing death is not of the God of life and peace. My hero, one of the people I love, is Edna St. Vincent Millay. Do you remember that poet from the 1920s? She's great. She had this poem which begins this incredible line, I shall die, but that is all I shall do for death. That's what you and I are trying to do. And that's what you're trying to do in Kansas City. And it's really good. This is the heart of the spiritual life. We're learning the old truth from Gandhi and Dr. King that violence doesn't work. War doesn't work. War always leads to future wars. It never leads to peace. War can't stop terrorism because war is terrorism. Violence in response to violence always leads to further violence. It's a never-ending downward spiral. And we're saying, we're trying to break this cycle of war and violence and not cooperate with it, to get rid of all guns and weapons and nuclear weapons and end this madness, this contagion of violence. But I invite you also to break the lie of the false spirituality of violence and say, war is not the will of God. War is never blessed by God. War is never justified. It's never moral. It's the definition of the demonic, because anything that brings death is not of God. So you can say it's anti-democracy, it's anti-community, it's anti-humanity, it's anti-creation, it's anti-God, anti-Christ. And Gandhi says, therefore, if this is all true, peaceful means are the only way to a peaceful future and the God of peace. But he uses this clumsy word nonviolence. And I've decided I'm going to throw in my lot with him. Because the word peace, oh my God, it's so co-opted. I spoke to the high school kids at Los Alamos. Just ponder these kids. Both whose parents were building nuclear bombs. Actually, the pit, the center of the bomb. And they're sitting on one of the largest cancer places on the planet. It's radioactive waste dump in this beautiful land, which is so poisoned. And they're saying to me, these kids, our parents have said, we're the greatest peacemakers on the planet. Nobody works for peace more than us. That's what I mean, the word is so caught. And the same with love. You know, I love my car. So I use the word nonviolence, and I invite you to use it. I want to say how I define it, and then just a little few points of my book, if you can still stand it. I think of it, and I get this from Gandhi's definition. He said so many beautiful things. But this is the truth of the spiritual life, as I see it, as Gandhi sees it in a nutshell. That we're all one. It's as simple and as hard as that. This is so easy, and the most difficult thing there is. This is the heart of reality, and very few people are talking about it. That every human being on the planet is your sister and brother. More than your blood sister and brother. We're all one, all equal, already reconciled. All of us children of the God of peace. All 7.2 billion people. So the spiritual life, or life, this is all this work that you're doing is you're going deep, deep, deep into the truth of our common unity. And the deeper you go, the more you realize, my brother, my sister, and you widen it to all creatures and all creation, and it's so beautiful. This mystery we've been created to enjoy. So you can never hurt anyone again. Or be silent in the face of 25 wars tonight, or nuclear weapons being built down the road, or catastrophic climate change, or a billion people are starving to death tonight. There's nothing passive about this, and we have to go beyond Gandhi and King. It's not even a tactic anymore. This is an active way of life, active love, pursuing this truth of our common unity, persistently reconciling with every human being on the planet, standing up publicly and resisting every structure of violence and institutional violence on the planet, allowing God to disarm our hearts at the roots of war in us, that we might really be instruments of peace. Practicing, this is what I think is so exciting, unconditional, non-retaliatory, all-encompassing, all-inclusive, universal love with one catch. As Daniel Berenson said, there is no cause, however noble, for which you and I will ever again support the taking of a single human life. This is the boundary line of nonviolence. We're not going to kill. No, we just have to kill Hitler or Saddam or Osama. No, the days of killing are over. This is the vision where we're coming from. And this boundary allows us to unleash new spiritual truths of universal life and balanced peace that we haven't gotten into yet. So I've been thinking about this forever, if you're still hanging in there with me. And I wrote this book, and I've been traveling the country talking about this so passionately, because it's really the work of my life. How do you talk about nonviolence in Kansas City? in the United States. How do you make it simple? And yet, I don't know. And so I came up with this formula, and I wrote this book about it. So here goes my thesis. See what you think about this. Nonviolence requires three simultaneous attributes at the same time. First, we're going to be really nonviolent to ourselves. At the same time, second, we're going to practice meticulous interpersonal nonviolence toward every human being on the planet and all creatures and all creation. Third, at the same time, you have to have one foot involved in the global grassroots movement of nonviolence. Well, I can see that didn't go over really well. Because, you know, my thought is that very few people do all three. We do one, and if we're lucky, we do two. But only Gandhi and Dorothy Day and Dr. King reached the fullness of the holistic life of nonviolence. Like, we might be really pretty peaceful people and pretty good in our relationships, but we're not doing anything about Kansas City plant or catastrophic climate change or poverty or prisons or war. That's not Christianity. That's not nonviolence. On the other hand, a lot of us are really, really committed activists. And we're mean, you know, we're angry, and we're working for peace. You know, because we're full of violence. I'm speaking toward myself. We're all in the same boat, and we, you know. So I just invite you to reflect on that. That's what I'm talking about in the book. And let me just say a word more about that. Number one, how are you doing with that? Being nonviolent to yourself. I'm talking about this now because the Dalai Lama is talking about this so much. He's going, I mean, if you live in a country that vaporized people and has killed millions of people around the planet, we just killed 500,000 children in Iraq, how many other 500,000 in this decade, waging 5 wars in the last few years up through Afghanistan. And he's just so internalized. The Dalai Lama is saying it's a whole culture of self-hatred and low self-esteem. If we can't make peace with ourselves, how are we going to make peace with anybody? So it's so interesting. Jesus said, yeah, love God and love your neighbor as you love yourself. So how can you go deeper into inner peace? We're talking about making peace with yourself. And I think that means not cooperating with your inner violence. Don't put yourself down or beat yourself up. Just look, I love what Thich Nhat Hanh says. He has a beautiful phrase. Look deeply within. What's going on? Why did I do that? How can I cultivate peace and interior nonviolence and be more nonviolent to myself? And this is really means experimenting in a Gandhian way with the real small details of day-to-day violence and nonviolence. And it really requires meditation, sitting with the God of peace, and just keep letting go of all the roots of violence within you. Your wounds, we're all wounded by this culture. You know, you're wounded as a child from the violence of your parents, your siblings, violence in school, then we can talk about violence of growing up in World War II, nukes down the road, racism, all these wars, we're victims. And then we go forth and become wounded wounders, as opposed to wounded healers. You know, so to really let go of our resentments and bitterness and violence, let the God of peace give us the gift of peace. I'm talking about the political implications of mysticism. That you can become a new kind of saint with such a dangerous spirituality that your very presence is a threat to the Kansas City plan or the Pentagon or Los Alamos. This is what the saints are about. This is what Jesus was about, like Gandhi was talking about. You go so deep in that our hearts become really disarmed by the God of peace. Things like that. And you know what? And forgive me for saying these stupid things. It's so basic, and yet I think it's the hardest thing there is. But the reason I keep talking about it is because we activists, you know, you're going to stand up and, like me, face the death squads in El Salvador or the Archbishop of New Mexico. Really rough out there. Or the Kansas City plant or the drones at Whiteman. You know, and somebody's got a gun or they're yelling at you. If we're not doing our inner work, we're going to lash out at violence. And it may have nothing to do with them. It's just because what our father did to us when we were five or something like that. Gandhi has this incredible sentence. I put it in the cover of the book. Nonviolence is the highest form of conscious living. And this is what Thich Nhat Hanh is talking about, being perfectly mindful, not mindless, really centered every moment in peace. We know ourselves, and when we're threatened, we're doing such deep contemplative inner work for peace and nonviolence, we can stand up publicly and not respond with violence because we're centered. This is what I'm talking about. Secondly, while you're doing that, really examine our relationships. All the people in our lives, and creatures and creation itself. I mean, we're all for peace, of course, but deep down there's someone we'd really like to get back at, you know, a little revenge going. I'm trying to make you laugh, but maybe I touched a nerve. Who is it you want to kill, you know, you want to hurt, or you just like to see them suffer a little bit? It's amazing. Or, you know, who? My grandmother used to speak of difficult people. That was a very nice, judgmental, non-judgmental way of saying something very judgmental. But, you know, who pushes your buttons? And it's so strange. They become your teachers of nonviolence because they're exposing the violence in you. And by the way, who, you know, how can you stop being violent to people? You know, when you're, and how to respond to people who are being violent to you? And work on the methodology of nonviolence in our relationships. And to keep widening that and experiment. And then third, at the same time, to be part of the global grassroots movement. This is what you're doing, and it's so darn important. It's so important. The world is moving. There have been 85 nonviolent revolutions in the last 40 years. From the People Power Movement to ending apartheid, the fall of the Berlin Wall, so forth and so on, up to Lima Gaboli, my real hero, who won the Nobel Peace Prize a few years ago, under the horrible dictator Charles Taylor, who killed 200,000 people in Liberia. One day she had a dream about Jesus, and she next morning she said, "I call upon all the women of Liberia to dress in white and let's just sit in the streets and say we've had it with you men." And they did it. They thought, well, we're going to be killed anyway. We might as well be killed saying no. And Charles Taylor's like, well, you can't work with these uppity women yet. And he left. Nonviolence works when it's tried. It's just rarely tried. Gandhi says, we have a force more powerful than all the weapons of the world combined. I'm going to quote Martin Luther King. He spoke like this every day, three times a day for the last 15 years of his life. He said, we have a power. Friends, we are not powerless. This is a methodology of movement building that always works. That's why we all have to be part of the movement. And if you're not involved, I say pick a cause and get involved. There's a lot of great things happening here in Kansas City, and Georgia can tell you, and Aunt Jane and all our friends here. Get involved. Remember what Romero said the night he was killed. Nobody can do everything, but everybody can do something. It's really, really helpful. And forgive me for being such a name dropper, but I was with Cesar Chavez just before he died. I'm thinking of him because the movie is out, and I haven't seen the movie yet, but I'm going to love it, even though it's gotten bad reviews, because he was so great. And I said to him, if anyone ever asks me, what should we do? What should I say? And he said, just like this, for the rest of your life, John, tell everybody, every day, for the rest of your life, public action, public action, public action. Everybody has to engage in some public action for justice and peace. That's the spiritual life. That's Jesus and Gandhi and Caesar. It's really humble. And, you know, change happens through grassroots movement building. I was with Howard Zinn, too, just before he died. He was the great author, historian of people's history of the United States. And he was in Santa Fe, New Mexico. We were having lunch, and he said, I spent my whole life studying the movements of social change in our own history, which is a very great way to spend your life. Think of it, he said. The abolitionists, the suffragists, those terrible women, the labor movement, the civil rights movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement. And then he goes, I had this breakthrough. I suddenly realized that all our own movements, from the beginning, the middle, right to the very end, We're hopeless, hopeless, hopeless. I said, well, that's really helpful, Howard. It really encouraged me. And he goes, I thought about it. And then there's a breakthrough of hope. And I asked myself, why? And I realized, because all of our movements have one thing in common. Ordinary people working every day for the cause of justice and peace, doing what they can, a little bit, the Xeroxing, the mailing, the bringing in the speaker, the showing the film, the organizing the protests. One, two, three things a day, every day, until they die, knowing they're not going to live to see the victory that they want. They did it anyway, because the good needs to be done. We do what's right because it's right. And this is how nonviolence works. It becomes a contagious movement, an alternative contagion that can disarm and suddenly wake up everybody in Kansas City. We vote out to close the Kansas City plant and Los Alamos and Oak Ridge. It's fantastic. And just to say that this is also the spiritual life. For those of us who are Christians, Jesus, Gandhi said, was the epitome of nonviolence. All his teachings are absolute radical nonviolence. Love your enemies. Blessed are the peacemakers. His last words to the church in the Garden of Gethsemane, put down the sword. And Gandhi said he goes deeper into nonviolence, even as they're killing him, forgiving and saying on the cross, the violence stops here in my body. The days of killing are over. You're all forgiven. But from now on, we're going to practice my way of nonviolence. And he rises and comes back and says, peace be with you. Peace be with you. Peace be with you. Now you walk that road to peace and go deeper into nonviolence and organize this movement. What we're talking about is the abolition of war and poverty and nuclear weapons and environmental destruction. This is what my friends and I are working on with the campaign nonviolence, which you heard about. I'll say a little bit more about it in the question period. We're trying for 300 demonstrations across the country this fall on themes of war and or poverty and or environmental destruction to get the movement moving. And this is the best thing we can do with our lives. This is the will of the God of peace for us. So I just want to say thank you, thank you, thank you. I want to encourage you to keep at it, to go deep into interior nonviolence, making peace in your lives, and together standing up, joining hands, and heralding a new world of peace, the coming of a new world of nonviolence, and fulfilling our vocations to be God's peacemakers, the sons and daughters of the God of peace. Thanks very much for listening to me.
You've been listening to The Forum here on KKFI. Today's speaker was Father John Deere, who spoke from the Kansas City Community Christian Church on April 2nd. Stay tuned for more great programming here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.